Welcome to the latest edition of the Consilio Better Places podcast, where I sit down with Marcus Mayer, Chief Executive Mark, and owner of the company which has been redeveloping the Whiteley for the last decade. It's a fascinating conversation, and I hope you enjoy.
Good afternoon, Marcus, and thank you very much for taking the time to join us on the latest episode of the Consilio podcast, Better Places, to discuss the Whiteley development, one of the most prominent regeneration projects in London. But before we begin the discussion, would you mind introducing yourself and explain what your company, Mark, specialises in?
Yeah, of course. Mark is essentially a global but European-focused private equity manager in real estate. So we focus on the residential sector, the logistics sector, and the retail, let's say, and mixed-use repurposing sector. So what that means is that we have a specific platform that focuses on managing mixed-use assets, but also repurposing them. And so Whiteley's is a very good and large example of that strategy that we've essentially executed across Europe.
So publicly, Mayor Bergman, as Mark was known at the time, announced its intentions for the Whiteley via an Evening Standard interview in June 2015, which I still remember, which where I first met you when we set this up with Jonathan Prynne and Joanna Burke at the Standard. It's amazing that still to this day I meet people who think Brunei's royal family bought the building, as that was following a Sunday Times story in September 2013. It'd be fascinating to talk us through the process you took in identifying the Whiteley as an investment opportunity, kind of the research involved to make what must have been a substantial investment, the purchase process, and really what made you take the plunge in purchasing a shopping centre that, let's be honest, had seen better days and had become an afterthought really when compared to the West End and certainly Westfield, which had opened recently.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So first of all, I lived in the area for quite a few years already before we bought it in 2013 or end of 2013. And my fingers sort of always itched, or my hands itched, you say it exactly, when I walked through that shopping center, because it's a beautiful building. There was an amazing historical facade, but essentially inside, it was completely underutilized, yep, misutilized, whatever you would call it.
And it turned its back on Queensway, didn't it? It wasn't open at all. A couple of entrances, but that was it.
Brick walls behind all the major historical windows, which seemed like a huge shame. And obviously it is in a very central, very well located part of London on Queensway, but certainly an area that was long overdue a regeneration. Yeah. And so, so every time I visited the asset, every time I walked through there, every time I shopped there, I saw it as an incredible opportunity, but it was relatively tightly held by Standard Life Insurance, who constantly invested quite large sums of money to try to make improvements, but they were always improvements sort of around the edges that didn't really, at the end of the day, ended up working to turn it around. And as you said, it was sandwiched between the West End and Westfield.
Yep.
And that meant that it was sort of a downward trajectory as a shopping center.
Yeah.
So we always bought it and we identified it as an opportunity to repurpose it into something different and not a shopping center, where we would reduce the retail footprint significantly, ideally only to ground floor, and where we would then reposition the upper floors into, let's say, hospitality, office, residential. And obviously, in the beginning, that was still kind of up in the air because it depended on the planners and the local ward councillors and the local community as well, on which direction was more likely to be successful. The buying process was quite unusual.
Okay.
In the sense that somebody had already secured the contract with Standard Life off-market.
Right.
And we had the opportunity to step into that contract. And because that was obviously, that's a relatively sensitive process from both a buyer perspective and a seller perspective, we kept that, you know, very quiet for a long time, which is why I think the rumors about the seller of Brunei kind of became pretty prevalent and remain prevalent.
It certainly do, yeah.
Exactly,
yeah.
Across the world.
Yes.
Because we end up meeting people sometimes in Brunei, but also across Asia and the Middle East, where people still think that.
Well, one Sunday Times article, and look how it spread. Exactly. It's incredible.
Exactly. Yeah. So that was sort of how it came about. In terms of how we really identified what we felt the best project was really a very collaborative effort with the planning authorities at the time in Westminster, the architects. So we've organized an architectural competition. We had Zaha Hadid at the time who presented. We had Norman Foster who presented. We had Ken Shuttleworth with a company called Make, and we had Stephen Trevelyan, I think, which is another architect that has had a lot of success
in Westminster, most definitely, yeah.
Exactly. And I think, generally speaking, you know, at the end of doing quite a lot of analysis together with the planning authorities, we all decided that the Foster scheme was the most deliverable Mm-hmm. Probably the best from a historical repurposing perspective. So keeping yep. the historical parts of the building, but also the best fit as a repurposed building with its immediate surrounding. And that obviously allowed us to sort of hone in on what mix of uses probably fit into that envelope the best.
So most people didn't realize that I think under the previous ownership, they'd also knocked the building down behind the facade and rebuilt kind of the modern Whiteley. So actually the historical elements weren't much, but they were so significant to the building. So for you, that historic element was of utmost importance and everything followed behind that?
I think what that historic element dictated, apart from just the attractiveness and the significance of the facade itself, mm-hmm. maybe the most important thing was the ceiling heights.
Yes.
Because the yeah. you know, the windows are, the windows obviously dictate the ceiling mm-hmm. heights to some extent, because you can't have a floor running straight through the middle of a window.
Yep.
And so that obviously limits the kind of uses that you could put in mm-hmm. the building, because to put, let's say, on that front facade, to put a hotel with, let's say, 6.5 meter or 20 feet floor to ceiling heights doesn't mm-hmm. make a lot of sense in a hotel room.
Yep.
It also doesn't make any sense for an office building. It makes a lot more sense if you want to build really generous, really special apartments.
Yeah.
So that meant that behind that front facade, and particularly mm-hmm. those very high windows, a residential use was the most logical step. And you see that all the way around the building, the same on the retail, mm-hmm. on the ground floor. Those four ceiling heights are really generous yeah. as well. And so obviously that pivots you more towards large restaurants.
I remember when we did residence meetings in some of the rooms, on the first and second floor, and everyone just commenting on floor to ceiling heights yeah. and just think, wow, this, you just don't get opportunities like that in London on a new build development to see that. It was incredible.
Most buildings obviously have, you know, 2.6 meters plus. If you're really lucky, you have 3 meters or 3.3 or 4.5 meters or 6.5 meters is extremely rare.
We'll come onto the sales process in a bit, but was that a key thought of when you were purchasing the building in terms of historical element will make you stand out? Because there was certainly a time, it's not really now because no one seems to be doing residential in London anymore, but in at the time there's a lot of yes. residential developments in London coming out the ground, and did this historical aspect make you take the plunge?
Yes, 100%.
Yeah,
because we felt that to be able to offer something unique to national purchasers in a city like London, we were convinced that that would really give us an edge on the sales.
Yep.
And it would give us a story. And most residential developments, even on the high end, as you know, mm-hmm. don't really have a story. It's just it's a developer, they find a site, they build a relatively cookie cutter building.
Yep.
And then depending on the quality of the facade and the quality of the fit out, it sort of determines the price point. But I think we had an opportunity here, we felt that, to create something really unique. And I think our success in delivering the building and our success to date in terms of the sales, bringing the hotel operator at the end of the day to the table, I think all of that wouldn't have been possible without that sort of unique features of the building itself.
Yeah, and so planning permission was granted by Westminster City Council in 2016 with a number of subsequent amending applications to kind of make the scheme more deliverable. Yeah, so planning permission was granted by Westminster Council in 2016 with subsequent amending applications before the shopping centre closed for good in December 2018. Now, right there and then, you must have thought, well, this build process might be quite tricky, but probably going to be okay. And you had your set budgets and your set timelines. But I've looked at the calendar from where we are today. We have Brexit. We have a general election of 2017, which led to Theresa May and then government essentially stopping. The election of Boris, delivery of Brexit, COVID, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Liz Truss, various legislative changes following Grenfell, global inflation, a new UK government this year, and now the re-election of Donald Trump. And seemingly daily, no one knows what's going on. How have you and the team managed to keep such a significant financial development on track? Were there times when you thought, oh, this is just too much, I'm selling? And how was it? How were the financial markets concerning the financing of the development?
Yeah, very good point. I think firstly, obviously we didn't really have, it didn't make sense to sell it, let's say, post-planning permission. And so we kind of, it was pretty clear at that point in time when the Brexit vote went the way it did that we had to stick with the project, or where we at least had an opportunity to bring a partner on board. So most of the rest of 2016, 2017, 2018 and 2019 mm-hmm. were really used to get all of those things in place. Because obviously we knew that at some point, if things went well, we would come to the point where we would have to commit to the development and, let's say, mm-hmm. a major construction contract, which we weren't prepared to do by ourselves.
Yep.
So luckily we got to that point, you know, all, let's say relatively quickly by 2019. Mm-hmm. Also, fortunately, in 2018, we brought Finn Chatten on board as development manager. And I think that was a huge, factor, I think, in us getting that development all the way ready to start construction on site in terms of the configuration of the residential units, making sure that we did our, let's say, our share of value engineering to make sure that we had no excess costs that were unnecessary, but delivered the scheme, let's say, that we really needed.
So they were brought on to take what you've got from planning and turn it into something deliverable. Would that be a fair analysis?
Yes. I'd say to something deliverable and also ultimately something, let's say, deliverable from a sales perspective.
Yep.
So making sure that it was the best configured scheme from a floor plan perspective, bathrooms, kitchens, all that stuff that would really support our sales.
Yep.
And determining the price points for each single unit that we felt was the right price point for the market.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that's a big collaboration between Finchata, but also the agents, Sales and Knight Frank, that we worked with actually to make sure that we didn't go to market with a price point that was too high or too low, which would have been,
suicidal.
The other big benefit of that was that Finn Chatten was really instrumental in helping us bring Sixth Senses to the table, because I think what Sixth Senses got sold on was that the story that we and Finn Chatten told them about the residential opportunity, I think, gelled really well with Finn Chatten's, with Sixth Senses' own culture and the way and their positioning, which is very much towards health, longevity, you know, the whole sort of human holistic element. Not so much, you know, we need to be in Mayfair because we're a luxury hotel with more, you know, with the immediate surrounding is not that important for us, but we need to focus on those things that our client base really cares about. And I think we were on the same page with them in terms of this whole scheme, in terms of regeneration, in terms of appealing, I think, to a very wide group of people from all over the world, from, let's say, the young entrepreneur that is successful enough to be able to buy a smaller or larger unit in the white lease to somebody who maybe has outgrown, not outgrown, but who has, you know, let's say the kids have left their big house somewhere in London and they want to downsize a little bit, but in a building where they have all of the sort of healthcare opportunities that you can find in a building in London. So that helped a lot to bring Sixth Senses on board, which then became a crucial element, obviously, to bring the financing essentially to the table and also the construction contract. Very fortunately, we managed to secure the financing and our joint venture partner and our construction contract all sort of between November 2019 and February 2020. And obviously very fortunate because by February 2020, COVID started.
Yep.
And had we not been able to meet that deadline of, let's say, end of February, I think the financing wouldn't have been possible. I don't think CC Land would have come on board as a joint venture partner once COVID really started to spread and Frontier started to shut down. And the same thing for a construction contract.
So how do you plan for that? I mean, is it the only unknown unknowns, as Donald Rumsfeld said, or a black swan event? How do you plan for this?
We had no choice because we knew that the demolition was going to be finished by, let's say, early 2020. And we knew that we didn't want to have a site that was mothballed between the demolition and the start on site. Because imagine, right, the demolition meant also digging a massive basement. Mm-hmm. And the construction contract that we were negotiating was essentially what they call a blue sky construction contract, essentially where the contractor goes up and down at the same time.
Okay.
So it wasn't that we had a contract to build the basement, including the whole basement infrastructure, and then we build on top of the platform. We had to get, once the dig was done, let's say, and the foundations were laid, we had to start the construction.
Yep.
Or it would have been a construction site that we would have had to mothball while we still found a contractor. So even though we didn't know about that COVID would happen, we knew that we had to get a fairly seamless transition between the two. Our, let's say, basement build contractor was the same contractor that we used for the whole basement construction, which is Lang & Rourke.
Lang & Rourke, yep.
So the basement was done by Expanded, and then Lang & Rourke took over. So even though they were two separate contracts, that helped us massively, let's say, prevent any inefficiencies between that basement build and the basement, which helped us at least keep to our timeline. A lot of difficult discussions with the bank that was financing us prior to that. So the fortunate thing was we got all of those three things in place right before COVID hit. And I think in view of your question about all these things that happened, I think that allowed us to sort of have a relatively straightforward process. But I think things could have gone really, really sideways. Yep. Had we not, you know, achieved those three major deliverables in the beginning of 2020.
How was the, don't expect all the trade secrets to be spilled, but how were the sales of the apartments going? We hear it's quite a tricky market in central London at the moment, but I also hear that the Whiteley's doing quite well on the grapevine. So how are things going? How have you found the experience, and is it like you thought it would be in terms of the sales process?
I think let me put it like this: when we started this process with Hitchhatton, we said to each other, if we manage to be 50% sold by the time the project is fully completed, that would be a really good place to be in.
Yep.
And the main reason is that, obviously, generally speaking, that would get you above your debt. So it would allow you to pay off your third-party financing, bank financing, completely at the time of completion, which obviously that means that you might still have a lot of equity outstanding, but at least it sort of stops the ticker on the debt, which gets super expensive if it stays out there for a long time. And that was, let's say, that 50% mark would get us comfortably there. We're over that 50% mark. Where the project shifted was that when we started off in 2020, let's say, with the base build and everything else, our aim was to get the whole project delivered on one single date. Unfortunately, because of all the things that, you know, came across our path, that didn't happen. Construction cost increases during COVID, Brexit increased, impact on materials coming from Europe and having to source alternatives, all those kinds of things. Yep. Basically, it became massively challenging through 2020, 2021, 2022, 2023. And that interest rate shooting up in the course of 22 and 23. So that single delivery date has shifted to multiple delivery dates, which has, you know, the impact of that 50% plus pre-sales was blunted a little bit by that.
Yep.
I would say if we compare, I think, Whiteley's with a lot of the other super prime skills and schemes in London, I think we've significantly outperformed almost all of the other schemes that are in the market today. I think that's largely, I think, due to the uniqueness of the product.
Yep.
You know, even though we're not in Mayfair and we don't have a straight park view, I think it's a unique building, and some of those elements that we talked about before, the architectural side, the floor-to-ceiling heights, the historical nature of the facade, like all of that makes it quite special rather than a new build, even though it could be very... That was probably the best development management partner and sales and marketing partner that we could have selected for the project. I think that's massively helped us on the sales side, whether it's existing clients that Valoron already had, whether it's, you know, it's also just the quality of the team there in terms of development management, so in terms of sales with Charles Lay.
Yep.
So I think they're the best group out there. That's been massively helpful. And then I think the third thing is probably just the unique nature of the location, where you're super close to the park. You're at a price point that is at a significant discount to the more established super prime area, so Mayfair, Knightsbridge, etc. I think that helps a lot. And then it's the immediate sort of submarket, the immediate surroundings, where you have, you know, a lot of very strong schools. You have Notting Hill basically on your doorstep. Public transport is fantastic. You're walking distance from the Elizabeth Line in Paddington. There's two tube stations on Queensway. There's one around the corner on Old Westbourne Park. So you've got this submarket there and the immediate surrounding that's super attractive.
I've always thought that between Queensway and Notting Hill was kind of the untouched area. But just people hadn't realised it. The location is incredible. And for all the reasons you've just mentioned. And one question we get asked as a company when we're doing residential schemes in central London, and as I said, there aren't that many at the moment, unfortunately, but there was a feeling that they weren't being lived in.
So the hotel element, the spa, the gym, the podcast studios, the children, the kids club, paddle court, all those things. And that converts into a basketball court. I think for Americans, I think that's something that is they wouldn't be able to find unless they moved on Grosvenor Square or, you know, in an area where it's probably not that convenient for them to live in terms of having kids and schools and everything else. And the price point, again, makes a big difference. I think we've also got a lot of people that already live in London, lived in London, and that essentially were looking to move from a, let's say, multi-story narrow townhouse, in most cases, to a lateral flat where everything is on one level. They don't need to build a basement, let's say, under their house to try to build a pool, which everybody always has terrible experiences with in terms of cost and time and humidity and everything. In this case, you know, you can swap, let's say, a multi-story house probably a similar price point, mm-hmm. where you have all that amenity in your building on a much grander scale, on a much larger swimming pool. Yes, you share it with people, but you don't have to deal with the construction to build it, the maintenance, and the fact that you maybe end up using it once in a while.
So has the profile of the potential buyers shifted then over the last decade? Because I assume at the start you would have had the assumption that China, Russia would probably, again, just a lazy stereotype, they were the buyers of central London properties, and that's it's changed?
Yes, but I think it's always on the move. A lot of things have happened that have made London less attractive for international buyers. It started with the Tories introducing higher stamp duty, you know, quite a few years ago under Cameron and Osborne. I think that really didn't help because, as you know now, the stamp duty is 15%, 17%, above 9.5%. That is a huge dampener, obviously, on selling super prime in the UK. And obviously all developers have suffered from that over the last couple of years since sort of 2018, I think, mm-hmm. when that was introduced. The second thing is geopolitical things. Obviously, we talked about China. Russians have been completely out of the market, so mm-hmm. I don't think we sold a single unit to Russian.
Well, you wouldn't have expected that when you start, again, this journey. You've had to pivot quite a lot.
But we didn't really start selling, I would say, until 2022, 2023.
Okay.
So we never really got impacted by that, let's say, in terms of, I think, the shift strategy. Mm-hmm. I think recently the non-dom
not helpful.
On the one hand, they haven't helped a lot because mm-hmm. I know quite a lot of people that would have seriously considered moving to Lightleys that already lived in London, but that now instead are moving to Milan or Switzerland mm-hmm. or Dubai or another place, because obviously from a tax perspective it has a huge impact on them. But had the situation not changed, mm-hmm. they would have seriously considered, I think, moving to the Lightleys. So I think that's more for domestic potential buyers that just have decided to move abroad. And I think there's quite a lot of those. But on the flip side, I think there are people that are getting attracted by the new, let's say, non-dom regime, which is a four-year regime, which is, mm-hmm. you know, not as attractive, I think, as the previous one for people, because 4 years is too short to build a business or to put your kids through school. But I do think we've probably benefited from that a little bit. So we've had some Asian buyers, for instance, that will benefit from that new four-year scheme. So I wouldn't say that's 100% negative impact.
Right.
It's probably more negative than positive, mm-hmm. but there has been a bit of an offset with some of those international buyers that will benefit from the new four-year scheme. And we don't know what happens going forward. I mean, obviously, sanctions might get lifted. Mm-hmm.
Well, every day was a different headline. Now, how can you plan? How can you plan?
So our sales team is just doing the best possible job they can to get mm-hmm. sales over the line. But I would say we're very fortunate in having had very strong sales progress to date, because the market today is quite tricky. It's quite slow. I think what will really help us is to get the hotel opened, which is probably forecasted now for July, August. Mm-hmm. I think that will really help reinvigorate the sales process, because I think the momentum, because I mean, once people can visit the hotel, they can see the mm-hmm. hotel amenity. I think that's a big unknown today because they sell under construction. So we're pushing hard, I think, to get that finished on time so that we can hopefully get, you know, some good sales done off the back of that.
For the local community, I remember at the time of the first planning permission, the staircase in the Whiteley was a really emotional pull for a number of people. The Whiteley was a place that it's for little things like taking the kids for their first school shoes or going on a date at the cinema at the time. So shopping centres have a real emotional attachment to people in ways you wouldn't quite expect. So the Whiteley staircase is going to be in the Six Senses. But alongside that, you've managed to secure, I understand, 80% of the units around that mark being let. You've got Third Space coming, Everyman, and then chains such as, or independent such as Melrose and Morgan, Cafe Yum. It's clear that high streets across the UK are struggling and the resale sector is just changing every 6 months, it seems. How challenging has it been to secure the lettings? And do they match the vision you had, again, going back to when you first considered the purchase? Is this where you thought you'd end up with this kind of retail experience you're going to be offering?
I think we're realistic and I think strategic in the sense that attracting retailers that were in the shopping centre before, like the Gap, Zara, H&M, you know, the Whiteley shopping centre didn't work because there isn't mm-hmm. a massive Zara in Westfield, and there was a massive
can't compete.
And also those kinds of brands would not tell you well with our residential customer. So saying to somebody, look, your main residential entrance for your apartment is right next to a Zara store, I don't think we've helped the sales. Whereas if it's you know, an artisan coffee shop or a townhouse, you know, a beauty salon or a gallery from Hong Kong, I think that's much more consistent with mm-hmm. our sales pitch. The other thing is that I think retail is struggling, but I think it's also struggling because in many locations the retail rents have been too high. In shopping centers, it's also, or it's been the retail rents and the service charges combined that have been way too high. And I think there's been a massive correction in those occupancy costs for retailers across Europe, the US, to the point where now you're starting to see the right locations pick up again. So Bleecko Street in New York, which as you know, sort of goes all the way from Nolita all the way to the West Village, to Meatpacking, Bleecker Street is now almost 100% leased. Whereas I remember in 2022, it was, you know, suffering significantly. And I think it's the fact that people are, you know, the working from home thing has significantly sort of gone back to people working at the office. I think rents have come down to levels where retailers can make good money again. And I think that's the same for Queensway. So our rents, if you look at our rental levels in Queensway, they're super reasonable.
Right.
And I think that allowed, you know, people to just look at the numbers and they add up their service charges, their personnel costs. The rent is a sustainable percentage of their overall sales.
It's notable that the lettings are independents, not chains, which I guess ties into that point about the rents being pitched at that.
Interesting, during COVID, most of the retailers that really retrenched and suffered were retailers that obviously had to deal with a lot of closures. So people that said, look, we've grown from maybe 50 units in the UK to 150, and now we need to basically close down 50 of them. And so if we would have, let's say, harassed those people to try to sell them on a location like the Whitey, they would have said, look, we're way too busy. We've got 50 stores to close. Like, we can't even deal with one single new location. So through COVID, and particularly towards the back end, the people that were really the most active new tenants were the independents, interestingly enough. They had maybe one or two or five stores, but that were still in expansion mode rather than retrenchment. And actually, those people have been able to secure some really good deals in the right locations. Now, what was also very important for us is, as you know, we secured the site across the street from White, which we've now sold to Vable, which is another developer. And I think that was really important for us because, obviously, we don't want to end up with a very good retail mix on the Whiteley side and then a very poor retail offering on the other side. And Vable's, I would say, their target retailer and quality of their developments in terms of architectural design and everything is very much in line with Whiteley's. And so I think that gave us a lot of comfort, the fact that Vable was the buyer and Vable will develop it, at least the retail. I think it gave us a lot of comfort that the retailers on our side will ultimately be happy with the quality of the retailers across the street.
It's noticeable that during the timeline of the development, there's been a real attempt by landowners and the council to improve the offer on Queensway. And this is the road that the Whiteley's on. I think we have to acknowledge former councillor Susie Burbridge. She was heavily involved at the time. Local community champion John Zammit, who certainly cares about the area, that is for sure, but has been a real help throughout this process in terms of the advice he's given. And the current ward councillors, Layla Cummingham, Ryan Jude and Eddie Ormsby. And also the fellow landowners, Bourne Estates, Fenton Whelan, GMS Estates and Vable, who you just mentioned. What do you see the future of Queensway being, given this joint public and private sector focus on the street?
I mean, I think you can see the change in Queensway already. The network rail, basically, London Underground, basically, is going to make some major improvements to the subway stations, particularly the initially the Bayswater Road Bund and the Queensway Road. And I think that will help, I think, make particularly that part of the street where a lot of the foot traffic comes into the streams onto the street a lot more attractive, let's say, for visitors to Queensway. So I think that will help a lot. I think once the new gate opens into Hyde Park, Kensington Gardens, I think that will have a really big impact because you'll have all the people streaming from the park into Queensway, which now, you know, up until now, as you know, there was no flow.
It's almost apologetic, isn't it, the entrance to Queensway at the moment from the park?
You have to walk past those public toilets.
Yes.
Little gate to go to Queensway now, and that will be the most prominent entrance to Kensington Gardens. So I think all of that will help a lot. Now, most of the ownership between Whiteley's, let's say, and Park Mueller and the Bourne Estate is across from, let's say, GMS Estates.
Yes.
Is individually owned buildings. So that will take a bit more time. But I think the good thing is you're already starting to see the change there. You're starting to see people.
It's very noticeable when you walk down Queensway now. Very noticeable.
Starting to see people make changes, invest in their own buildings or selling their properties if they don't want to invest in them and sell them to somebody who's going to invest. So I think it's a gradual process. I don't think you will really see the final or close to the final sort of positioning of the street until probably 1 or 2 years from now. But I do think it will accelerate as the Sixth Sense opens,
yep.
And they will start their development across the street.
Yeah, I mean, Bloomberg recently ran a piece saying about Quinta. So, I mean, it certainly shows people are noticing. Absolutely. And that wouldn't have happened a handful of years ago, that wouldn't have happened. One aspect of the White Lily we should touch on is the community element. Consilio, along with Justin at CC Land and local ward councillors, run the White Lily Foundation. To date, $350,000 has been distributed to local charities and initiatives, including sponsoring 3 students for a year with a scholarship for the University of Westminster, which, having been involved in some of the interviews, I mean, the students are so grateful for the opportunity that's being given there. Alongside this, we're actually organising, as we speak, with the Future Tenants and Westminster City Council, the White Lily Jobs Fair, which we hope will see hundreds of Westminster residents find jobs when the White Lily is open at all the different retailers and the hotel. How important has it been to the project team that the local community also benefits from this development? And as you said, you're a local resident yourself, ensuring that everyone can buy into this development.
I think it's very, very important, because I think we want the retail, for example, to perform very, very well. And obviously we don't want the local community to shun it because they're not rightly positioned or because they have some real aversion to the one you had to development.
It will only work if the footfall from Queensway goes to the to the shops, won't it?
So I think positioning that the right way is really important. I think that from the very beginning, I think we needed to get the buy-in from the local community in terms of getting the right support for the planning, making sure that we were not one of those typical Greater London developments where you have 10,000 letters of complaint and 5 letters of support. Which happens quite often.
Very often.
And so for us, we wanted to make it a win-win. And I've met a lot of people that live in the immediate surrounding area that obviously could see the bigger picture, that were prepared to maybe deal with 2 or 3 or 4 years of disruption in terms of construction, noise, trucks going up and down, to deliver building materials and take away the dirt from the dig and all that stuff. I think most people that I've met were very supportive of that in order to end up with a repositioned Queensway, repositioned area. Of course, a lot of people own property around White Lease, and so they can see an immediate positive impact on the values of their property, which helps. Now, you've always got people that don't want any change, but I do think the completed product has really surprised a lot of people on the upside. I haven't met a single person yet that, let's say, that has visited the finished product or walked past it and that said, oh, wow, it's disappointing. Most people say, look, a lot of people that I meet say, look, I expected something cookie cutter, like typical developer product, and actually it's beautifully done. The quality is incredible. And it's a real game changer for that part.
I can testify to that. We organised for the Christmas tree light switch on, and it was the first time many people had actually been in the development. Now it's nearing completion, and you could just see people looking at it. Oh, I get it now.
Yeah.
You really can see that when people see it now.
I don't think there's an equivalent. I don't think there's an equivalent in London.
No.
With that development.
No. Before we finish, I'm sure many of our listeners would be interested to understand more about your current opinions on the state of the broader property market. I mean, as we've alluded, given the news cycle changes at such a rapid pace at the moment, I guess it's hard for anyone to give a solid prediction for 2025. But you've just come back from MIPIM. What do you see the outlook to be this year? What was the mood of people?
I think the mood is still quite subdued. I think obviously there's a lot of contrasting signals, because obviously inflation is picking up again.
Yep.
Or at least there's been a slight pickup to 3%, and that I think here in the UK and Europe, it's a mixed bag. I think that gives people concern about higher for longer, so rates staying higher for longer, and probably not as many cuts as
banked in.
On the flip side, obviously you see pretty weak GDP performance in the UK and in continental Europe. That's kind of putting pressure on central bankers to lower rates. So I think my takeaway was people don't have a lot of visibility. At the same time, I think from an investment market, capital markets perspective, I think because people have been sitting on their hands for quite a while for the last couple of years, pension funds, insurance companies, etc. I think people feel that it is time to invest again. So that's positive. And I think a year ago, that was already starting. I think this year it will be more. There will be more investment volumes. People will make more commitments. So it's really about being very thoughtful about what kind of opportunities you pursue and where you see, a really good risk-reward trade-off. And so for us, I think you know, there is still, across Europe and the UK, I think there's still a lot of uncertainty about regulatory change. In continental Europe, more than the UK, there's a lot of uncertainty around, let's say, residential rental regulation, rental caps, growth caps, things like that. Construction costs have flattened a bit in terms of the evolution, but I think nobody's really seen a big downward trend on construction costs. So that hasn't really pushed a lot of people to do significantly more development. Funding costs, mortgage rates, as you know, haven't really followed interest rate decreases. No.
Has somebody remortgaged? Yes, I can assure you that is certainly true. Yep.
So I think it's still a challenging year, but I think there are green shoots on the horizon. Do you think that people are hoping that the conflict in Ukraine will be stabilizing soon?
Yep.
There's a conversation between Putin and Trump tomorrow. I do think that those kinds of things help a lot. Now, at the same time, you've seen trade tariffs and things like that. So I think the Americans are prepared to obviously deal with short-term disruption for probably longer-term, more beneficial economic conditions. And we're all going to have to live through that to some extent. So what it means for us is that we're focused on strategies where we don't expose ourselves too much to, let's say, things like construction cost risk, interest rate risk. So higher yielding opportunities without a significant development construction cost risk, I think, is probably where there is, and there's a lot of that, where there is a sort of chronic shortage of supply and an increasing amount of demand. So the multifamily rentals, logistics, those have very strong upward pressures in terms of occupancy and rental growth, and the supply, because of construction costs, interest rates and everything else, just isn't there.
You have a logistics fund, Cross Bay 2, which was reported at the end of 24. You've got a total investment capacity of 1.5 billion to target the urban logistics sector across Europe. Just finally, is that the market that you are going to focus most on across Europe this year, or is there something else people should be looking at?
No, I would say that our two highest conviction strategies on this Cross Bay 2, now we're already significantly committed on that fund, which is great. So we'll be fully committed before the end of the year. It's my expectation, and then we still see a lot of opportunity there. So I think we will start raising Cross Bay 3 quite soon after getting fully deployed on Cross Bay 2. The other sector that we really like is multifamily in the UK. You know, with all the additional regulation that you refer to, Grenfell regulation, I think it's putting massive pressure on the big housing developers. And I think if you can get exposure to the UK multifamily market with the huge sort of restrictions on new supply, the massive amount of capex that existing landlords need to invest in older properties, I think, you know, the pressure on rents will just continue there. The stamp duty increase that's coming online on the 1st of April is obviously not helping the sales market. So, and all of that is just pushing more people to essentially have to rent. And so I think particularly if you focus on the affordable side of the PRS market, I think, you know, that's going to perform very, very well over the next couple of years.
It does seem it's the unspoken conversation at the moment is the post-Grenfell regulations and the impact this is having on just stopping residential development. I can speak from Considero's perspective, you know, we're busy, thankfully, but it's not on residential. And you just wonder, it's outside of London, actually. I mean, around Cambridge, South Cambridgeshire, there's a huge residential pipeline probably growing. But in London, it's just... And it seems to be, there's a lot of reasons, but the post-Grenfell regulations, and I understand there's a sensitivity in talking about it because they've been introduced with the best of intentions, but everyone says to me, got a sotto voice.
But it's the same in continental Europe. There never seems to be coordination of policy. I'm from the Netherlands, and the Dutch did everything they could to kill off the housing market, the new delivery market. And then on top of that, they brought on board rental caps, so rent regulation. So 95% of the Dutch resi market is now rent controlled. And the only thing it means is that everybody who owns buy-to-let property is selling. And so all these properties are being removed from the rental market. Nobody can afford to build for rent because the construction costs, planning issues, all the things that you mentioned. And so at the end of the day, you know, the existing rental stock is just getting rarer and rarer. And the politicians usually, the policy that's now being put in place, it's the same in the UK, was devised 3 years ago when interest rates were 0.1%. And now that the regulation is starting to have an impact, you know, you need the exact opposite. But by the time, I think, unfortunately, unless they, you know, they really change their approach, by the time they get their act together and start to bring regulation in place to sort of re-energize that PRS market, it's going to be too late. Then they're going to miss the boat again. So it's challenging, but I do think that, unfortunately, those kind of disconnects between the politics, let's say, and the market do offer a really interesting opportunities, which is where I think some of the current opportunities are
coming. It always amazes me that the most optimistic players are those involved in property, because you've always got to look at it being half glass full. Otherwise, you'd never get going because of all the headwinds. You just couldn't do it. Exactly. So this is a time for opportunity.
Absolutely.
Brilliant. Marcus, thank you very much.
Thanks, Nick.
Thank you for listening to the latest episode of the Consilio Better Places podcast. I found that a fascinating conversation. Thank you, Marcus, for giving up your time and sharing the journey you've been on over the last decade with the White Lead Project. And if anyone hasn't been down to site, I really encourage you to do so. It is looking fantastic. Now, please make sure you subscribe to hear further great conversations with future guests, including Shravan Joshi, Chair of the Youth London Planning Committee, Graham Craig, Head of TfL's Places for London team, the Chief Exec of Hunt Council and the Chair of the Cambridgeshire Chambers of Commerce, the founder of Compton, a quite exciting property agency specialising in the City Fringe, the Labour Yimby movement, and the leaders of Free is Free Local Authorities. Thanks for listening, and remember to subscribe and share.